The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
President Trump and his campaign have filed a number of lawsuits against key battleground states. These legal actions come as Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden now leads in several of those crucial states.
One day after the U.S. broke its record for most cases in a day, the country did it again. Officials reported more than 121,000 cases Thursday. On Wednesday, the U.S. became the first nation in the world to pass 100,000 cases in a 24-hour period.
Because the spike protein is going to be different in this new strain of coronavirus or COVID, the vaccine may not be protective for that particular strain. And that is the concern of scientists.
We're heading in the direction of Europe in terms of the pervasiveness of the infection here across the United States. Whether or not we need a national lockdown, I think we can deal with this effectively with targeted mitigation on a state-by-state basis. But we're not doing that right now. And so we're building up a lot of trouble for the future. And I think that this is going to explode in several weeks. We're going to see these case numbers really start to explode.
The 2020 elections delivered some big results for the marijuana industry. Measures to legalize medical and recreational use of marijuana won in every state it was on the ballot.
This election was one of the biggest head fakes in history. Like it or not, the people have spoken. They want divided government. Whether Biden or Trump ends up on top, it's looking like Biden right now. The Democrats will have the House, and the Republicans will likely have the Senate, which means at least 2 years of boring, do-nothing government! Americans seem pretty satisfied with the status quo. They don't want upheaval, and they certainly don't want higher taxes, something that would have been on the agenda if the so-called blue wave had washed over Washington. And that is a big deal. This year, the Democrats were talking about raising corporate and capital gains taxes, and that would have hurt a lot of people's portfolios. These Democrats were much further to the left than the last time around.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The week started with a nice rally on Monday from oversold conditions. And, you know, I spent about 12 minutes discussing this situation on Monday with the weekly technical update I bring, along with Chris's fundamentals. You can find these videos on financialsense.com by clicking on the plus icon at the top and then clicking on our video section. Basically, Chris and I record our Monday investment meetings, which is for our own benefit, now sharing that with the public. Exactly what are our thoughts on the market backdrop? So I wanted to let our listeners definitely know about that one. It's a great resource, and it's something we'll be doing every single week. So the market did bounce from those oversold conditions on Monday, with leadership concentrated in cyclical stocks because of the stronger than expected manufacturing ISM number for October, which was around 59.3 versus 55.4, and the highest since September of 2018. So a very good move right there in manufacturing. Interestingly, the new orders index, which is helpful because it's a leading indicator, hit its highest reading since January of 2004 at 67.9, which was seen as a real positive in the face of stimulus uncertainty, president uncertainty, and a growth curve in COVID cases. The rally carried into Election Day with the sense that the uncertainty surrounding who will be president may be over soon, on top of a stock market that could still be considered oversold after losing 5.6% in the S&P 500 last week. You know, 10 of the 11 sectors in the S&P 500 finished up on the day. The only one down was the energy sector, despite a rise in oil prices. I think the real story for this week's performance set in on Wednesday, when investors began to settle on the current state of the election and what it means for stocks. There was a strong sense, number one, that by Wednesday, the Senate would remain Republican, and by then, Biden had the most electoral votes, so it was looking like a Biden presidency, Republican Senate, Democratic House. So a split Congress would make it very difficult to change the existing tax policies that currently favor lower corporate taxes, individual and capital gains tax rates. On the other hand, it also limits the extent of a large fiscal stimulus plan. And finally, a legal challenge from Trump could further delay the outcome of, obviously, the presidency and a passage of any kind of stimulus. In that type of an environment, Long-term treasuries rallied, causing rates to fall, which benefits growth stocks. The Nasdaq was up 3.8% on the day Wednesday, while cyclical and small-cap stocks underperformed. Obviously, those two sections, small-cap stocks, cyclical stocks, would have benefited from a Democratic Congress and a large stimulus package. Maybe not so much for, you know, taxes. The final narrative to finish the week is the sense now that stocks have rallied too much in a short amount of time, allowing for a simmer down now period. At one point Thursday, the S&P 500 was up 7.9% for the week in four sessions. The sense that stocks needed to cool off continued into Friday despite a very strong employment report. The non-farm payrolls increased 638,000 jobs and the unemployment rate fell to 6.9%, down 1%. So despite that, the market was still negative by the time of this report. Some interesting highlights worth mentioning this week were Qualcomm's earnings. Ride-sharing stocks were up due to the classification of contractors still in California versus employees. And Biogen receiving a favorable report from the FDA on its Alzheimer's drug. I think the reaction to Qualcomm's earnings, in addition to Skyworks and Cirrus Logic beating earnings, is a great sign that while there have been some fears on the delayed launch of the iPhone 12, it may be misplaced. Qualcomm has done a very good job diversifying its portfolio for 5G, and that was evident in their earnings report, along with their willingness to give upside guidance for the first quarter of 2021. So that's it for this week's wrap-up report. It's still uncertain how much of a legal battle will draw out the presidential election, but in this environment, investors have elected to crowd what's worked up until now in a low-growth environment, growth stocks, and technology.
One of the most significant things about Bitcoin in 2020 is volatility. The measure of risk on Bitcoin is actually clearly declining versus volatility in virtually every risk asset on the planet is increasing. Well, let's look at the NASDAQ. I like to use the NASDAQ as an example because volatility in the NASDAQ in almost all the stock market has been increasing. But Bitcoin has been basically the same price as the NASDAQ almost all year. It was right around 10,000 for a while, and then it was 12,000. Now it looks like Bitcoin's breaking out to the upside. But the key fact is the measure of 180-day volatility in Bitcoin as of today is below that of the NASDAQ.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow at financialsense.com.
Well, the stock market seems to be liking what it sees as a result of the election. And maybe it's just glad that the election is finally over. So where do we go from here? Joining us on the program is Art Hill from Trend Investor Pro. Art, let's talk about the S&P. We had, 2 weeks of a downturn, and now it looks like it's up and away.
Yeah, I think this is just a continuation of the uptrend that started in March. You know, my charts, I've pretty much just stopped looking at everything before March 2020 because the most important price action is what's happened since. And we had this, you know, huge run up from late March to early September. And then we consolidated. We moved sideways, SPY, QQQ, the NASDAQ 100. And I think it was just a normal correction, lasted anywhere from 9 to 10 weeks to digest those big gains. And we got a nice bounce off of the lows from September this week with a big week. This is the biggest up week so far since early April. So it looks like we're going to get a breakout from this consolidation that went on from September and October and continue this uptrend. It's a bull market.
You know, let's talk about technology stocks. They've been obviously the leader all year long, a big beneficiary of the pandemic. We had some pullbacks earlier in September. We had another one as we got into October, but looks like it's up and away again. Do you see technology stocks maintaining that lead? And let's talk specifically about stocks like Amazon, Apple, Google, Netflix, things of that nature.
I do see technology kind of doing the same thing, as I said, as SPY. And then, you know, of course, the S&P 500 is like 27%+ weighted by the technology sector. And then the top four stocks, I believe, account for 20%. So it's clearly, you know, the big driver in the S&P 500. But if you look at the NASDAQ composite, it's got that same pattern. It's more straight up from March to August and then rested from September to October and looks to be resuming. And Amazon is, of course, leading the way. It's got a similar pattern, you know, that big advance, a two-month consolidation, and now it's surging off those September lows and could be poised to break out and continue higher. The same thing with Facebook, new high in late August, early September, a consolidation and heading for a breakout. And Google is leading the pack, Alphabet, because it's already at a new high and has broken out. So it's clearly a leader. And you mentioned Netflix. It's a bit of a laggard because, you know, it peaked in July and it's been moving sideways since the middle part of July. But again, it's above the rising 200-day. You can see these lows in July held in August and then in September and now in late October, early November. So I think the path of least resistance is always up for, also up for Netflix. And, you know, who knows? You know, winter is coming and COVID has not gone away. So instead of going out, Friday night might be at home on the couch with Netflix again.
What about Apple?
Apple is also, you know, it's carrying along like the rest of them. It peaked in early September and then fell back. It's not as close to the September high as some of them are, but it's well above its 200-day. So I would say it's still in good shape. It's just not quite leading as much as some of the other ones like Alphabet, which has already hit a new high.
Well, let's move on to healthcare, especially now where, you know, where you're at. Europe is going through a lockdown. Some states here are still in a partial lockdown mode. If you take a look at the healthcare sector, XLV has just spiked recently. What's going on with healthcare?
Yeah, I think healthcare really likes what it has seen from the election with it looks like the Republicans will control the Senate, and that could bode well for the healthcare sector. XLV is a pretty broad-based representation of the sector with a lot of large-cap pharmaceuticals and biotechs in there. But it's just been, you know, really got boring healthcare because it had that big surge from late March to mid-April, and then just kind of worked its way higher, holding above the 200-day since the latter part of April. And then it woke up. It started surging on Monday and Tuesday. I think it was anticipating something like this, and then really got the big bid on Wednesday when it hit a 52-week high. So I think this is just a reinforcement of a trend that was already there, and it's kind of accelerating. And within healthcare, I'm seeing leadership in the smaller biotechs, the XBI. The biotech SBDR seems the strongest of all.
Let's talk about something that has not done well, and that's energy. It still remains in the doldrums. Doesn't look like there's any chance of it moving out of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're talking stocks, you really need to focus on stocks that have hit a new high within the last few months or that are trading at new highs, or ETFs, you know, you need to focus on that area. When I look at oil, you know, it doesn't look too bad. Oil in and of itself, if you look at West Texas, you know, it's been really pretty much just flat since June. So it hasn't gone down, hasn't gone up. It's just kind of hugging that 200-day. But if you look at some of the stock-related ETFs like XLE, well, it hit a multi-month low in October, in late October, so that's no good. And then you look at the oil and gas exploration and production ETF, the equipment and services ETF, it's been trending lower since June, well below its falling 200-day. Now, could it get an oversold bounce? Definitely. You know, it's way overdone possibly, but it's not a leader. You know, if you're looking in the stock market, I think you got to look more towards the leaders.
And, you know, you take a look, it's hard to believe if you look at within the energy section, you look at companies like Chevron and Exxon, some of the big oil stocks, it's hard to believe that Exxon, a number of years ago, was the most valuable company in the U.S., and now it's a former shadow of what it once was. It got removed from the Dow, and there's a question on whether it's going to maintain its dividend.
Yeah, Exxon had the big surge with the market from late March to early June, and then just started working its way back towards those March lows. It's quite close to those March lows now. You know, banks kind of did the same thing. They had this big surge in early June, and you thought, okay, banks are catching fire. And then they started working their way lower. They caught a bit of a bid in October when we thought the reflation trade was taking over, but they didn't react well to the election results, the banks.
Something that really strikes me is normally, depending on whether we're in a risk-on or a risk-off market, you see a change between, let's say, consumer discretionary and consumer staples, but they're both doing well at the same time.
Yeah, if you look at the consumer staples, SPDR, it's got the same pattern pretty much as SPY or QQQ. And, you know, it had that new high in September, and then it kind of started working its way lower the last 2 months above its 200-day moving average. But still, you know, as far as octane, it doesn't have the same amount of octane, say, as the technology ETFs, of course. You know, if you want to get outperformers, you're going to have to turn there. But it's still, you know, the cup is still half full for consumer staples. And of course, consumer discretionary has been driven by retail. And the retail SPDR, XRT, hit a new high in mid-October. If you recall, the S&P 500 didn't hit a new high in mid-October. The NASDAQ 100 didn't hit a new high in mid-October. So retail is really leading. And they've the XRT has caught a really good bid the last 4 days.
So let's move on to another area, and let's try to bring all these together in terms of how they relate. Let's talk about the dollar, TLT, which is the 20-year treasury, and then gold.
Yeah, the intermarket arena really got a bit of a shakeup. You know, if you start thinking in intermarket terms, you know, you think, okay, the stock market's surging to new highs. That would be a negative or, say, a risk off safe haven like treasuries. But treasuries did catch quite a bid this week, you know, getting a really big bounce over the last few days. But still, treasuries are stuck in a trading range, basically, since March. They've just been going sideways and down the last 3 months. So they're a bit short of a breakout. What I noticed was high yield bonds really got a nice bid and are breaking out. And that bodes well for the stock market because they're more positively correlated with stocks because they're more sensitive to the economy. So the breakout in the HYG, the high yield bond ETF, is quite positive. And you mentioned gold. Gold seems to be positively correlated with treasuries, TLT, because they both kind of declined over the last 3 months. But I think gold is going to shake that off because it's already breaking above its October highs this week and looks like it's finally ending its correction. It's above the rising 200-day. It peaked in early August and had a falling wedge that retraced a little over half, which is like two steps forward, one step back. And it looks like it's breaking out this week to continue higher. So I would be bullish on gold. And then that, of course, segues right into the dollar. the dollar, it's below, it's falling 200 day. It hit a low there in August. And then when the S&P 500 moved sideways, the dollar kind of firmed, but it's kind of a consolidation within a downtrend. So the S&P 500 is a consolidation within an uptrend. So we expect an upside resolution because the path of least resistance is up. But the dollar is a consolidation within a downtrend. So we expect a resolution to the downside because the path of least resistance is down. So that would bode well for gold if the dollar breaks down.
So, and speaking of precious metals, let's talk about silver. Typically, you know, as gold took off this year, we saw silver confirm it. Silver took off after languishing for probably almost a year, reflecting more its industrial side. But then also the gold stocks. I mean, if you look at GDX and many of these big gold mining stocks, whether you're looking at Newmont or you're looking at Barrick, they've done well. So all three of those were moving in the same direction. Do you see that pattern continuing?
Yeah, if you look at GDX, it had a massive surge in the summer, you know, from the early part of June up until the early part of August. So it hit a 52-week high, and then it corrected over the last 3 months with a pretty typical corrective pattern in this falling channel wedge thing that, you know, it's kind of two steps forward from June to early August and one step backward. And it looks like if gold's going to break out, you expect GDX to follow and also silver to follow if gold is going to break out. Silver, I have to admit, is it can be really volatile. You know, they call natural gas the widow maker in the futures market. Well, I think silver is a pretty close second when it comes to volatility, but I would think silver will follow gold. And if you look at the base metals ETF, DBB, you know, it's breaking out to new highs. So that's a positive for industrial metals.
Let's talk about, and especially industrial metals, we've got to talk about copper.
Yeah, good old Dr. Copper. It is leading that move in industrial metals. You know, it was at a multi-year low in March, and now it has exceeded its 2019 high. And if there's anything I could point my finger to, it would probably be China. Because if you look at the China CSI 300, the A-shares ETF, it's hitting a multi-year high. And it has broken above its 2018 and 2019 highs. And of course, a weak dollar helps that. But Asia seems to be, especially Southeast Asia, Korea, Japan, China, are performing better than the U.S. right now.
So given what you're seeing in the charts, it looks like these bullish trends, that are, whether it's market, it's precious metals, are continuing. How would you be putting money to work right now? Is there anything that really stands out to you that is a good investment play here?
Well, a few things do stand out that are based on some themes that we're seeing playing out and some longer-term trends. The XBI, the biotech ETF, it's a very broad-based biotech ETF, and it is near a 52. It hit a 52-week high this week, so it's in a strong uptrend, and that kind of spreads the risk a little bit versus the IBB, which is more weighted towards large-cap biotechs. I like the XBI better. I'd also like gold at this stage because it is looking to continue its uptrend as the dollar breaks down to continue its downtrend. And I would also like the technology shares, you know, be it QQQ or the software ETF or the semiconductor ETF, which hit a new high in October, pulled back, and is breaking out again.
All right. Well, listen, Art, it sounds like it's still a bullish market. So given this trend, if our listeners would like to find out about your website and the services that you offer, tell them about it, please.
Sure. My website is trendinvestorpro.com, and I do specialize in ETFs and broad market timing. And I've got a breadth model, and it weights a different an array of breadth indicators for the S&P 500 and takes a weight of the evidence approach as far as the market timing is concerned. And the breadth model is bullish. The trend timing model is bullish for the S&P 500. And then I rank the ETFs according to their chart patterns and chart strength. So the strongest are at the top, and the ones that are off my radar are at the bottom, like energy. So at the top this week, you know, I've got some clean energy ETFs. I've got the healthcare related ETFs and the technology related ETFs at the top. So trendinvestorpro.com if you'd like to take a visit.
All right. Well, listen, Art, stay safe, and hopefully they'll be opening up at some point in Europe, and we're hoping that whatever happened there doesn't come here. Stay safe, my friend, and come back again.
Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Joining us on the program is Owen Tracy from Fuller Tracy Money. And Owen, I wanted to have you on the program because we're hearing lots of stories when it comes to COVID that Europe is going through lockdown again. Some U.S. governors are talking about the same. Let's talk about this in terms of what it does to the markets, what it does to the economy, because you can't shut down your economy forever or a large swath of it and expect the governments to, you know, bring in the tax revenues. They're all complaining they're not getting tax revenues. Well, if you shut down business, what do you expect? So let's talk about Europe.
Well, Europe is in a bit of a pickle. They tried the whole turn it off and turn it back on again way of fixing things that all computer tech people know, and it didn't work. So now they're trying it again. But the reality is that if you switch everything off, the only thing that you can do in tandem with that is to boost the production of more money. You've got to keep printing because otherwise you're going to have a depression. So Europe is into lockdown. They're doing it for a month, and that's their expectation. They're trying to do it now so that they can still rescue the holiday shopping season. And a lot of businesses depend on the holiday shopping season for survival, so they want to make sure that that happens. But this is really a rerun of what we had in the summer, because the reason that the number of cases in Europe is rising now is because of the summer holidays. When you look at where it started off, it was in Spain and France, and those are major tourist destinations. The places where people go to or come from to go there are places like the UK and Germany. So all of those places now have got a lot more cases because they tried to rescue their tourist businesses. And now we're at another lockdown because they want to rescue the holiday season, which means that all other factors being equal, there'll be another surge in cases probably in February of next year. Because after this lockdown, there'll be another surge in cases. All of these lockdowns were originally designed to slow the spread, not to stop the spread. So the reality is that we're going to be in rolling lockdowns. As long as people are willing to tolerate this kind of activity, it means that governments are going to have to keep printing, and the figures that they're going to have to keep printing are going to keep rising.
Yeah, because the U.S. just reported its budget deficit. It was $3.1 trillion. And, Owen, that was half a year of good economic growth because the government's fiscal year ended in September. They're talking next year we could see a $4 to $5 trillion deficit, depending on the amount of stimulus that they're talking about. How long can governments keep issuing that kind of money in a lockdown without the bond markets beginning to revolt? Because we are seeing a backup in some of the yields if you look at, for example, 10-year treasuries in the U.S.
Well, I think there are two important things to pay attention to. The first is that historically, since 2008, any time that they've introduced quantitative easing, bond yields have backed up. and they backed up by anywhere in the region of about 200 basis points. If bond yields rise 200 basis points from where they are today, then it represents a $100 billion increase in the cost of servicing the debt. And let's not forget, I mean, you know, the U.S. spends about $74 billion a year in education. So that would represent an increase in servicing costs for the debt of more than we spend on education. And that's the kind of hit that government finances are going to take if bond yields rise. So if we are going to have quantitative easing, and we're already in quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve said that they're going to buy $120 billion worth of bonds a month, then it's rational to expect yields to back up. But the government can't possibly deal with that, regardless of who wins the election. No government can tolerate an increase in costs of $100 billion. So that means that quantitative easing this time has to be different. Instead of buying shorter dated bonds, the Federal Reserve is going to have to buy longer dated bonds. They're going to have to try and flatten the yield curve. And that's yield curve control. And the Federal Reserve has already said they don't see that as being a rational way of dealing with the issue that is at hand. But I find it very hard to believe that they can do anything else. There's no way the government can tolerate this amount of or an increase in their cost of borrowing. And therefore, the Federal Reserve is going to have to control the yield curve. If it does not, well, then yields are going to rise. We're going to have a much more difficult economic environment. The stock market would take fright because of all of that additional debt and worry. So the Federal Reserve then has absolutely no choice. They have to start buying longer dated bonds. And that is going to be stimulative, which is why the stock market is beginning to rally now.
Owen, as you see these governments going to lockdown, it shuts down the economy, revenues stop. And then what we're doing is we're talking about giving people stimulus checks like we did in the U.S. with PPP, giving businesses money, extra checks for unemployment. Now, when you're doing that, at the same time, you're shutting down production, the production of goods, or limiting the production of goods and services, and giving money to people to buy those goods and services. And at the same time, the Fed's printing money. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, the possibility of inflation.
Well, inflation occurs, I think, most acutely when we get through the crisis, because you can't really have inflation until the velocity of money starts to pick up. So a lot of the stimulus is being saved or it's being used to pay back debt. But we've had a massive increase in money supply. And you can do that without inflation as long as there isn't a lot of economic activity. But as soon as we get through the pandemic, and this is not going to last indefinitely, within the next month, there's quite a few of the phase three trials are due to provide data, and there will be vaccines. Now, we can have any opinion about the validity of the lockdowns, the validity of having to wait for a vaccine, but the reality is that in order for politicians to walk back their continued emphasis on social distancing and lockdowns, they need to have a rationale, because there's no way that a politician is ever going to admit that they're wrong. So they're going to wait until there's a vaccine, then they will allow social distancing measures to ease. At that point, the economy takes off. There is an incredible amount of pent-up demand in the economy. I know that my family are dying to take a holiday. And it's been a long time since we were able to enjoy ourselves and go off and just have a carefree couple of weeks off. And I think there are a lot of people in that boat. There are a lot of people are going to want to party as soon as the social distancing measures go down. That's all wonderful for economic activity and velocity of money. But when that happens, and against a background of massive debts and against a background where there is no tolerance among the population anywhere for fiscal austerity, well, that means we're going to have inflation. So we're not seeing inflation today, but we're going to have inflation probably by the end of next year. And then we have the fact that the Federal Reserve is going to be forced to try and keep yields under control. So then we're in an environment where you have inflationary pressures and yields will not be allowed to rally. And then people will be in a panicky stage looking for a hedge, which is why gold is doing well.
So right now, let's talk about the commodity sector. You've had oil prices basically have been locked around $40 a barrel. You've had gold, which has been sort of meandering around the 1900 level. What would you expect to happen with commodities? Now, I'm going to talk about three in particular that have to do with the economy. One would be energy, the other one would be copper, and then, of course, gold.
Well, I think oil is probably the most interesting because sentiment is so incredibly negative towards it. And depending on how spending goes over the next few years, we may have a big new Green Deal. It's already been announced in Europe and in China, so it's really only a question of whether it's entirely global. But then obviously that's going to represent a challenge for oil, but at the same time, that's a long-term question. It's certainly 5 years out on the horizon. Because all of this infrastructure takes a long time to build. And that means that oil has got plenty of time to rally between now and then. And some of those energy shares are extremely cheap. I think the reason that they are so low is simple enough that people are betting that carbon credits are going to become extremely expensive and that basically the conventional oil sector will be taxed in order to fund a Green New Deal. But the oil price itself has got plenty of scope to rally, and that should start to pull some of those bigger companies higher. And I think particularly if you look at companies like Royal Dutch Shell or ExxonMobil, they produce more gas than oil anyway. And natural gas prices have rebounded way more impressively than oil prices. So I think oil is cheap at these levels and has ample scope to rally because of the potential for reflation. Then if we start to be serious about pricing in the potential for Green New Deal expansions in Europe and China, then that represents a very significant demand growth story for copper. There was one statistic I saw recently, which was that if all of the UK's cars, and the UK is a population of about 60 million people. If all of their cars were made electric, it would represent all of the supply of copper in a year. And that's the kind of growth that a lot of the people who are supportive of green technologies want to see. So it means that there's likely to be a significant demand growth story for a lot of industrial resources. So they're still cheap.
When it comes to copper, we're talking about this Green New Deal, electric cars. My own state of California, you won't be able to buy a gas combustion car here after 2035. But all those green cars, Owen, require copper. I think a Tesla takes about 189 pounds of copper. So it's not just infrastructure, but if we're going to a green transportation system, whether it's electric trucks, electric trains, electric cars, all of that requires copper.
It's all copper and it's all aluminium because when you think about power to weight ratios, well, one of the reasons that they can get electric cars to go 300 miles is because they are building the bodies out of aluminium. So then that's an additional demand growth story. But then when we think about gold, well, all of this is going to be done with a lot of money that's printed out of nowhere. And we're very much in the modern monetary theory reality today. Governments are in a position where they have got extremely restive populations. And to me, at least, this looks very like the late 1960s, where we had a massive social justice movement There were a number of assassinations of prominent figures within a couple of years of each other. We had then the Summer of Love. We had Woodstock. These were massive social things that happened in the 1960s. And governments, and then, of course, the student protests in France. So governments got scared, and they just printed. And one of the things they did was they built a huge number of houses on the basis that the way to civilize the younger generation was to give them a mortgage. So there was a huge building boom. There was a lot of debt monetization. There was a huge run-up in debts. That was the factor that started to seed inflation. It was the jump in inflation. And that was the, I think, one of the causal factors in the Gulf states demanding more money for their oil, which then created the oil embargo. And then we had a real inflationary problem. Well, we're really now in the late 1960s phase of that. So it means that the decade of inflation is probably in front of us, which, again, is why gold prices are doing better.
So given this fact that we're probably entering an inflationary environment, that would bode well for, let's say, commodities, as we've been speaking. What about also emerging markets? Because if the U.S. runs up massive trade and budget deficits, that weakens the dollar. Wouldn't that be good for emerging markets?
It will be good for emerging markets. And then the big question for those emerging markets is really about how well they can deliver on growth. And I think, you know, considering the real benefit that they have is large young populations, they're going to be comparatively less affected by the coronavirus, but they do need the global economy to start firing on all cylinders again in order to really get growth moving once more. But with commodity demand growth picking up, and then the linchpin will be the dollar. The dollar has really only just started to decline. It's got a long way to go from here.
So given that, if you had to put money to work in taking, let's say, a short-term view, we're doing this interview on the day of the election, so we don't know what the outcome is. But whether it's Biden or Trump, what we do know is the Fed's going to be printing money and the deficits are going to be massive. So how would you be investing money?
Well, I think the safe way to invest money is just to simply buy gold today. It's been consolidating for 3 or 4 months, and I think there's limited downside. So that's, I think, the easy way to make money. It's low risk. If one were to want to take some additional risk, well, then I think that a number of those big energy companies are extraordinarily cheap. But you do have the risk of regulation being their primary headwind. So instead of going for the energy companies, I think perhaps the easier way is to go for the industrials. When we think about what's going to happen in terms of delinquencies, in terms of debt loads, there are a lot of companies still have to deal with all the debt that they've accumulated over the last decade. But a lot of the industrial companies like General Electric or Rolls-Royce or the Chemours company, they have already gone through massive processes of rationalization. And that means that they're primed to grow. I think that one of the defining characteristics of 2021 is going to be a significant rotation out of the stay-at-home champions and into more of the industrial companies that are levered to global growth, because all of this money sloshing around is going to create a period, at least for a while, of synchronized global economic expansion, because we're coming off of such an incredibly low base.
Owen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do there at Fuller Tracy Money, how can they do so, please?
Well, you can simply plug it into Google, Fuller Tracy Money. We're a subscription service. We provide a daily commentary and daily audio and video commentaries on top of that. So we've got lots of different media that people can access our information from.
Well, listen, Owen, stay safe and come back again. We'll be right back.
Jim, I want to ask you about the market reaction that we saw. Very, very strong reaction to the election outcome. Of course, things are still undecided and some states are up in the air. It looks like it's siding towards Biden. But as we all know, we did not see the predicted blue wave. Stocks reacted very favorably to the outcome. Both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ saw their biggest post-election rally on record. And on the day that we are conducting this show, it is Friday, November 6th. Stocks are consolidating slightly from the big move that we saw on Wednesday and Thursday, but down only marginally. And actually, the NASDAQ is up by about a tenth of a percent. So what are your thoughts and your post-election analysis when you think about how the markets performed and took the events in stride?
First of all, the uncertainty is being removed, although I would question that uncertainty because this still hasn't been decided, and it's my view it's going to be decided in the courts. But what I think the market took a look at is a divided government. So the blue wave that was predicted by pollsters in the media didn't happen. The Republicans picked up anywhere from 8 to 10 seats in the House, and also they're holding on to the Senate, which is key. So a lot of these radical proposals, whether packing the court, getting rid of the Electoral College, making Puerto Rico and D.C. the 51st and 52nd state, that's not going to happen, at least in the next 2 years. So the market's saying all this stuff that one party wants to do when they control all branches of government, that's not going to happen. So if Biden wants to, for example, pass a spending bill, a tax bill, it's going to have to get through the Senate, and there's fewer members in the House with the Republicans picking up 8 to 10 seats. So the majority in the House isn't as strong as it used to be. And I think that's what the market's doing. They're looking at a divided government, which means anybody's particular agenda is unlikely to get passed. In other words, there's going to have to be some kind of compromise. And I think that's why the markets reacted in the way they did.
So rather than wide sweeping changes when it comes to tax policy or even regulatory policy, if we were to think about, you know, Green New Deal type initiatives, putting lots of regulatory fines on the energy industry, a lot of those things now, perhaps, you know, worst case fears that if we did see a blue wave, those things are now off the table. If Biden does ultimately secure the win, he's going to have to govern more from the center.
Yeah, I think that's what the market's looking at this. A lot of these radical proposals, the Bernie Sanders part of the wing of the party, a lot of that, you know, you're just not going to be able to push that through. Now, had they won the Senate overwhelmingly and picked up more seats in the House and strengthened their lead, then I don't think we would have had the same reaction in the markets. But right now, the markets like what they're seeing, divided government. So none of the extreme proposals are likely to get passed, at least in the next 2 years. However, though, I think there's other uncertainties here that we still have to deal with, and we should talk about that. Number one, because of all the widespread cases of fraud that are being reported and being suppressed, a lot of this is going to end up going to the court. There's, I think, filings in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Georgia may have to go through a recount. So, Chris, we're not done with this election yet, and we may not. I think the date is December 8th when all the states have to confirm their electoral votes. I don't know if we're going to be there on December 8th. In other words, this can go well into next year, which is going to be an element of uncertainty as we go into year end or into next year if we still don't know who the president of the United States is.
Right, yeah. I mean, if we think about 2000, Bush versus Gore, that wasn't decided by the Supreme Court until December 12th, and that lasted about 5 weeks, so a very long time. If, you know, we're a couple days afterwards and already we're getting impatient, but man, that was one state that was in dispute, Florida. If we're talking about multiple states, that just ups the game and the uncertainty even more.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's been so many. I mean, there was a reported incidence, I forget what county and what state, but there were 230,000 votes that magically showed up in a batch. Not one vote was for Trump. How likely are you to have a district where 100% of the votes, not one vote, went to Trump? So a lot of this stuff is Georgia's being challenged, Nevada's being challenged, Arizona's being challenged, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. I mean, we've got 7 or 8 states here. So this could be tied up into the courts for longer than many people expect. How the markets will react to that is something that we're going to have to watch closely. And then the other thing we're going to have to watch very closely is the spike in COVID cases. You've got Europe now, which is in a lockdown. The number of cases in the U.S. is starting to pick up along with deaths. So what would happen if, for example, let's say Biden is president and we go through a national lockdown? What would that do to the economy? And then also, if you're going to go through a national lockdown, what would have to be the compromise in terms of what kind of stimulus the government's going to have to pass to offset shutting down the economy? So this is, you know, we're not out of the woods yet, either on the election or with COVID. So we're still going to be dealing with that into the end of the year and well into next year.
Jim, who are the big losers in this process? I mean, as you mentioned, Democrats obviously didn't secure the major win that the polls were predicting.
You know, I think if the losers, if the media had any shred of integrity left, it was lost in this election. I mean, the outright bias of the networks, I don't care if you're looking at the major newspapers, the Times, the Post, the networks themselves, you know, they were predicting this massive landslide, a big blue wave, and it didn't happen. So I think the media once again got it wrong, and any shred of credibility, I think, is gone. I think the second loser in all of this were the pollsters. And let me give you an example. There were three strongly contested Senate races. One was Susan Collins in Maine, Lindsey Graham, and then Mitch McConnell. And the pollsters in the media told them that they were in risk of losing their seats. Well, on election night, it turns out they won them by a wide margin, high single digits, and in one case, double digits. So I think the pollsters were the loser. And then I think the third is the election process itself. We have altered, you know, a lot of these states altered the rules, and I'm thinking of Pennsylvania, where the legislature sets the rules for voting. And in Pennsylvania, the deadline for voting is 8 p.m. on the night of the election. Well, you had a judge come in and threw that out and said, no, we're going to extend that by another 3 days. So you've got all these various alterations of how we traditionally vote for a president. So, and then they stop counting votes at 10:30 at night, and then all of a sudden these large batches come in and changes the outcome the following day, which is one reason why all of this is being challenged. So I would say three losers here is the credibility of the media, whatever was left of it, pollsters. I mean, how can pollsters, you would have thought they would have modified what their models or how they conduct polls, because Chris, I used to do polling when I was in college, and I can tell you, I can skew the outcome of any poll by who I talk to and by the way I word the questions. So the big thing is, how could they get it wrong the second time? So I would say those are probably at the top of the list, the big losers.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking about how we had two different people to present both sides on predicting who would win president. And the most accurate election model that is out there, which has predicted 25 of the last 27 elections, if you don't include this one, was predicting a landslide win for Trump in 2020. And it's interesting because that prediction was made before COVID. So that was made in very early on with the initial primaries, which is what that model's inputs are based on. And so it really does seem that if we never saw COVID, Trump would have very, very likely had secured a second term. Because you think about it, the pollsters got it wrong again. The media got it wrong again. If he was already as close as he was with COVID and with all the criticism that he had received on how he handled COVID and the blame that was being pointed at him, it's very clear that he would have won if COVID never happened.
Oh, most definitely. But nonetheless, this is the world that we're dealing with now. So the two risks that we have as investors going forward, and I'm going to bring up a third risk, that is the election being postponed in terms of determining the outcome for a lot longer than what we're anticipating, going beyond December 8th. And the second is another wave of COVID. Now, let's talk about a third risk. The third risk, the government just reported its budget deficit was $3.1 trillion. We are talking about a national debt now that's over $27 trillion. And remember the budget deficit for 2020. In that 12-month period of time, we had 6 months when we weren't in a COVID lockdown where the economy was booming. Remember, we began the year with the lowest unemployment rate in history. So it was looking really good from an economic point of view, and the government's fiscal year begins in October. So it wasn't really until the end of March that we really start getting into the lockdowns that would impact government revenues and government spending. Fast forward to where we are now, and they're talking about, and who knows how this is going to play out, either this year or even the beginning of next year, but they're talking about another stimulus package that could be anywhere from $2, $3, $4 trillion. So the budget deficit for 2021 is estimated it's going to be in the neighborhood of $4 to $5 trillion. So, you know, let me put this in perspective. In the year 2000, the national debt was $5 trillion. Fast forward 2 decades later, and we're looking at a national debt that is going to exceed $30 trillion in the next 12 months. Now, where this becomes important is because interest rates are at historically low levels, the government is paying roughly about 2% on all of its outstanding debt. So let's just take $30 trillion at 2%. That is interest expense, annual interest expense of $600 billion a year in climbing. Now, what happens if inflation starts to heat up next year, which I think it's going to do, and we'll get into that in just a minute, and the Fed is unable to contain interest rates? In other words, the bond vigilantes show up and demand higher interest rates. Well, think about this. If interest rates go from 2% to 3%, that's an additional $300 billion in interest. In other words, annual interest expense is going to be approaching $1 trillion a year. And sooner or later, Chris, I don't care what they talk about monetary theory, the risk to monetary theory is inflation. Inflation starts to show up. It could overwhelm the Fed's efforts and government. And it brings back James Carville's famous saying. He said, if I was to be reborn again, I'd like to come back as a bond vigilante so I can intimidate governments. And that's what happens when the bond market reacts. Think of the pig crisis back in 2011, when you saw interest rates, for example, in Greece spiked to 30%. You saw in some of those pig countries, interest rates at 9 and 10%. What if something like that happened? Sooner or later, we are heading for some kind of a financial crisis. You can't add $3, $4, $5 trillion a year to the national debt without sooner or later running into a problem. So I think that's a risk that we've just kicked the can. But sooner or later, I would say in the next 2 or 3 years, that's going to be a major problem.
Well, Jim, when you're talking about some of these risks, I'm hearkening back to the 2000s when you were warning investors about the tech bubble and writing very regularly about how, hey, you need to be prepared for tech stocks blowing up. And that's what happened. And you were also urging investors in the early 2000s to rotate into commodity stocks, writing The Next Big Thing and a number of other different pieces saying about how we're going to enter a long-term secular bull market in the commodity space. That obviously panned out very well. Where would you say we are from a big picture, you know, when it comes to some of the investment implications of the risks that you're talking about now?
I think we're heading into an inflationary period. I think in the next year, we're looking at a great market. I think the market will do well. We could be approaching 3,800 or maybe 4,000 on the S&P. But just like the market when it bottomed in 2002 and it went up for 5 years until 2007, if you look what drove that market up, it was mainly commodity type plays. Emerging markets did well. Base metals did well. Precious metals did well. Oil did well. And I think you're going to see that again. I'm very bullish on precious metals, base metals, and especially copper. Man, I, you know, 25% of my portfolio is in copper plays because you're talking about this transition that eventually we're going towards a green economy. Well, if we're going to move towards electric cars, every electric car requires a large amount of copper to make it work. And so look at what is happening to copper. We're seeing copper starting to come close to exceeding some of the highs that it hit back in 2011. So I think the next decade is going to be all about hard asset type plays, whether it's going to be real estate. Look how well the real estate market is done throughout this COVID crisis. And even today, you talk to real estate agents, they're telling you it's a shortage. You know, somebody I know put their house on the market here in California. It sold in 2 days with basically four offers coming in well above the asking price. So real estate we see doing well, but I think it's going to be a different kind of real estate. I don't know if I would be very bullish on commercial property, given what's happened with this digital economy, where we're finding what we can do without a lot of office space. And if you take a look at the contraction that's taking place in commercial real estate with the retail sector, with more and more malls closing down, more and more stores going under, and I think that trend will continue. So we see hard assets as a major play in this next decade, Chris. And just like the last decade, also, if you take a look at what's going on with the dollar, that's going to bode well for commodities as well. The only one we're not really bullish on to some extent is what's happening in the energy markets. I do think the price of energy will go up, but I think it's going to take getting beyond COVID and shutting down economies. Because if you're shutting down your economy like you're doing in Europe, and if we end up doing that here as we head into the winter months, well, what that means is we're going to be using less energy. And of course, that would weaken the demand for energy. However, if a lot of the Biden Green New Deal proposals work their way either through executive orders or through Congress, you're talking about his goal to phase out fossil fuels. And so, you know, that doesn't bode well. So a lot of this stuff is going to be in flux. But just as the last decade was a decade of paper assets, if you were in stocks, if you were in bonds, anything that was a paper asset, you made a lot of money in. I think this is going to reverse in this decade, and it's going to be hard assets. And like I said, I'm very bullish on gold, silver, copper, base metals, anything that comes out of the ground. I don't care if it's fertilizer. I mean, I own fertilizer stocks. I have probably only one oil stock that I sit on right now. But very big in copper, base metals, precious metals, fertilizer, a lot of the stuff that comes out of the ground, I think is going to do well in this decade.
So Jim, as always, if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us and speak with any of our financial advisors about some of the things that we discuss and how we can assist them, what would be the best way to do so?
You can call us 888-486-3939, and one of our advisors will be glad to talk to you. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.